You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in once again to the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I am an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. If you've listened regularly to our show, if you follow the news, or if you are even remotely conscious these days, you know that we're having all sorts of political troubles, ranging from hyperpartisanship to a budget crisis to racial tensions to, well, you name it, and there's some kind of problem with it. And even worse, it seems that there is no help coming from our political and cultural institutions. But why is that the case? Why are our political institutions failing to do their jobs? That, of course, is a big question, and here today to help us answer a small part of that question is Ira Shapiro, author of the new book, Broken: Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? Mr. Shapiro worked on the Hill in numerous positions in the Senate. He has also served on teams that helped create NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. In 1995, Mr. Shapiro was confirmed as an ambassador and has specialized in negotiating trade agreements with Japan and Canada. Today, he is the president of Ira Shapiro Global Strategies and the author of The Last Great Senate: Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, as well as the book we're talking about today, which we will get to in just a minute. This, by the way, is just a small sampling of a long and distinguished career in public service. Mr. Shapiro currently lives in Potomac, Maryland, with his wife, Dr. Nancy Shapiro, who is Associate Vice Chancellor at the University of Maryland. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be with you.
So the name of your recent book is Broken: Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? Before we get to the implied no that I think probably answers that question, and before we ask more generally how the Senate is broken, I first want to ask what, in your view, a Senate that's not broken would look like. If I say that my car is broken, we all understand that it's not doing something that it's supposed to do. So what is the Senate supposed to be doing? What would a healthy Senate look like?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking it. A healthy Senate would look something like the Senate I wrote about in my first book, The Last Great Senate. It was characterized by mutual trust, a lot of respect among the members, commitment to the national interest, and an engagement on a bipartisan basis. Those people didn't all agree on the issues, but they engaged in a bipartisan process because they felt that was the role of the Senate. The Senate was what Walter Mondale once referred to as the nation's mediator. That's where all the interests come together and got worked out. It happened all the time. So what we see now, of course, is the hyper-partisan Senate and almost what could be described as tribal politics, where the leaders can't overcome the differences, and indeed some of the leaders make the differences worse. And Coyle, if I could say, the Senate I wrote about in the first book, you see it stepping up to one problem after another, domestic and foreign policy, at a time, and in the late 1970s, we had energy and economic problems, we had foreign policy problems, but we had a Senate that helped this country get through it.
Now, how much of that is I don't want to say it's all sort of cultural and circumstantial, but certainly in the 60s and the 70s, there was sort of a great enemy out there in communism, right? It was the height of the Cold War, and there was at the time this feeling that if we didn't work together, we were going to be overtaken by communism. Today we don't have that. Is the change in the Senate just a difference in kind of world circumstances, or is there something internal that's been broken as well?
Yeah, that's another great question. And everyone who thinks about it looks at how much of this is forces beyond our control or the external forces as opposed to the actions of individuals. certainly that was a different time. The men, and they were all men, out of the World War II, they had a view of how to work for the nation. They worked together. And then there was the threat of communism. But I think there's more to it than that. I think, and I'm a Democrat, so I'll freely disclose that. But most of the literature would suggest parties moved apart as their parties realigned and they got further apart. So we had a much more unified Republican Party and a more unified Democratic Party. That's an important part of it, but they also, that still brings upon, makes the responsibility of leaders to do what they can to overcome those differences. And I can point, in my book, I point to several important times when the country didn't have to be divided on partisan grounds, but it was the choice of the leaders to do it.
Right. And how did we come to this? How did the Senate get broken?
It came to it in a long, the way I describe it, is a long decline that started almost 25 years ago when the Senate no longer had the ability to overcome a more polarized system. They essentially gradually succumbed to it rather than overcoming it. And then the gradual decline that I'm describing turns into a deep dive. Becomes a much more accelerated downward spiral toward gridlock and dysfunction. And that, I believe, started with, that last period started with the intense opposition of the Republican senators to Barack Obama.
Sure, and I do want to come back to that a little bit later. I think you certainly see opposition from senators to the president, you know, sort of throughout American history. But you do especially right. focus in on, especially Mitch McConnell, right, and the Senate Republicans leading a minority resistance.
Yes.
Which I think I actually agree with a lot of your analysis in the book. We both read Mitch McConnell's memoir, The Long Game, and I think both of us really wish we had the Mitch McConnell of the memoir and not the Mitch McConnell of the last, you know, 12 months or so.
Well, I appreciate that your agreement with me and that you're also referring to the memoir. I believe the interesting thing about the memoir, if read closely, it's a candid document in many ways. If you read the first few pages and his commitment to the Senate and to bipartisanship and to everything else, and then you get into the memoir, later on you don't see that. The actions don't go that way. And I'll just give one example because it's always stuck with me. We were in a national economic crisis. We were going toward the second Great Depression at the beginning of 2009. And the new president, Obama, comes in and we're close to a depression. Senator McConnell unites the Republicans against the economic stimulus bill. And he unites them even before Obama's in office. And to my mind, that's something leaders, I don't know of any other leader that would have done it under those circumstances. And the other point that relates to it, which troubled me most, just 3 months before, and you'll remember this from the book, the memoir, just 3 months before, Senator McConnell played a very positive role in dealing with the first part of the economic crisis. He stepped up. Then 90 days later, it's the exact opposite. And that's just plain partisanship. He just wanted the president to fail.
Right. The Bush stimulus was a good thing. The Obama stimulus was a bad thing.
Right.
Not sure. Because of any substantive objections, but because of partisan politics.
Yeah. New president. He says it. Well, Obama's coming into office. He's got very high approval ratings. We better do something.
Right, right. And you sort of, you see that theme. And of course, we're not here to talk about Mitch McConnell's book, although I will cheerfully encourage our listeners to go read it. It's a fascinating book, for sure.
Just as long as you encourage them to read the first few pages and then think about the rest of it.
Right, Well, and read Broken alongside it, right? We'll keep it balanced here.
I said at one of my book talks, I'm actually not here to pump up Senator McConnell's sales.
A couple of questions to sort of go in a more positive direction. What can be done to fix the problem? What can be done maybe first by the Senate, and what can be done by the American people?
I think that frames it exactly right. I actually think the Senate can do some considerable things on their own. And one of the most frustrating things, if you study it at all, is that the senators hate the Senate that they're in. It's quite remarkable. They can't stop talking about how much they hate it. And they write articles, they write books, and they clearly know what the Senate is supposed to be, and yet it's not that. So they seem to take one of two courses of action. They hunker down and do the best they can in a broken institution, and some of them do better than others legislatively, or they quit. They go home because it's terribly frustrating. I would suggest the third option, which is change it. And you can change it in any number of ways. The simplest way to change it was the one that occurred in 2001. Senator Jeffords of Vermont jumped from the Republic, became an independent, and the Senate became a Democratic majority Senate. He changed it, and there was no crisis at the time. So a couple of senators could change the majority if they wanted. If they're not willing to do that, the common sense coalition that emerged during the last shutdown, led by Susan Collins and Joe Manchin, if they can hold a group like that together, they can create a more bipartisan Senate, because Senator McConnell, in his work, particularly this last year, he's been counting on a unified majority, 50 or 51 of them holding together. If somebody says, as they do, well, Senator, we're not going to work that way. We're going to go back to the bipartisan way, and you don't have 50 votes anymore. So that's a way of changing it. There are others, too.
But do you think just switching majorities will do anything? I mean, are the Democrats really that much better than the Republicans anymore?
Yes. No. I actually do think it would change it. I mean, I'm not saying, let me separate, honestly, the possibility that that will happen from whether it would change it. And in 2012, my first book, I wrote at the end of it, the Senate needs new attitudes, new rules, and new leaders. Well, when I thought about it later, the attitudes flow from the leaders. The leaders would put new rules, a process for making new rules. So it actually does come down to leaders. So I said they needed new leaders because Reid and McConnell were failing. Well, Reid's gone, but McConnell's still there. Maybe one more new leader.
Yeah, and I will admit I don't know enough about Chuck Schumer to know where he falls procedurally, because of course he's we haven't got to see him as majority leader yet. So yeah, it's hard to know.
I don't know Chuck Schumer personally, and I don't agree with everything he's done. But he has a history of accomplishment, and including bipartisan legislation on one of the hardest issues you can have, our immigration situation. And I think that the ideal world would have been two new leaders coming at the same time together. We don't have that. So we have the option. And I'm speaking honestly of my sort of long thought process. I think we have the option of the Senate switching and changing majority leaders, which nobody's talking about yet, or we have the option of enough pushback from the centrists that steered Senator McConnell in a different direction so that he thinks, well, I can't run the Senate with 50 votes because I don't have it. What I need to do is what I just did on the budget deal. Worked with Schumer. We'll pass that thing in the Senate. Take the most, if you have one more moment to think about this, Coyle.
Sure.
Take the most difficult thing that will be coming up perhaps this year. I mean, the Russia investigation is going to be a huge thing. But let's take something really serious. Let's suppose that this year, Justice Kennedy decides that he will retire. That was rumored last year. He's been basically the swing vote on a lot of important decisions. If Donald Trump decided to nominate a very strong conservative in the Scalia-Gorsuch tradition, there will be a very, very bitter fight over it. I don't know. It'll be a fight that'll make the previous Supreme Court fights look minor. So what do you do about that? Well, one thing you do is you get a group of senators, several of the Republican senators, who say to the president, Mr. President, you have to nominate somebody who's sort of a moderate conservative, moderate, very well respected, who can get 60 or 65 votes. And the president says, or the attorney general says, no, we don't need 60 or 65 votes. We can ram it through with 51 votes. And the answer of the senators is, yes, sir, but you won't have 51 votes. We won't vote for someone like that. We voted for Gorsuch because it was not an ideological, he was an excellent qualified person, and it was not an ideological change in the court. But we will not do that again.
So on the point you made, so I agree that would be an institutional stand that I would love to see the Senate take. There's a part of me that is suspicious that such a stand would have been made, say, had Ginsburg retired under Obama, and or Kennedy even retired under Obama. I don't know that I would have seen the Democrats leading the charge for another centrist. So I can respect the idea of that sort of institutional integrity, but I wonder whether either party really is actually going to do that under any circumstances, let alone under ideal circumstances.
Well, I understand this. I understand the skepticism, and I haven't heard the idea from anyone else. And in fact, I didn't put it in my book because I just thought of it.
Sure.
But I think when you look at it carefully, it doesn't take that many people to change it. It really doesn't. And in terms of your Ginsburg and Obama, the point about Obama, Obama's nominees ultimately got more than 60 votes. So, and I think there are certainly justices that could be appointed by a Republican president who would get more than 60 votes, but it can't be, you know, in the Scalia-Gorsuch tradition.
Yeah, my wife's suggestion was that when Scalia died, Trump should have nominated both Gorsuch and Merrick Garland on the condition that someone else retire.
Yeah, the 3G strategy. Ginsburg would have retired. That was the theory. But look, right. your wife is a wise woman. That would have been something of a healing exercise. But when people have the chance, thus far, when people have had the chance to heal and bring people together, the answer has been to reject it. I'm suggesting that circumstances are such that it might be changed. And here's the reason it might be changed, Coyle, from my standpoint. We have now a president who poses a significant and different danger than previous presidents. And I think, I'm not prejudging where Mueller investigation comes out. I'm just saying what we know and what we have seen in the president's first year. We need a Senate that is strong and effective now. It's supposed to be a check on a potential overreaching president. It would be one of the real problems of history, right, if just when we needed the Senate most, it was at its most divided and worst. I think you have to overcome that.
Yeah, and I think that that leads into the second part of my initial question is what can be done by us? I mean, to some extent, I think there's a good argument to be made that Trump and the problems in the Senate are not necessarily institutional problems as much as they are problems with the American people. I mean, I guess you can respond to whether or not that's accurate, and then talk about what is the role of the people in restoring the Senate and restoring our government in general and so on.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And in fact, the senators will have to gauge their response. They gauge their response on what they're hearing from the people, too. It's not just an internal game. So what's the role of the people? The people should insist, well, and they are mobilizing. People will perhaps turn out the Republican majority or put a terrible scare in the Republican majority. The people have to come out and vote. They can't have the usual fall off that occurs in an off-year election. I think everyone knows that we're in an extraordinary moment. One of the things that I describe is, I believe that our democracy has been like the frog in boiling water, slowly dying for a period of time. And the election of the president, Donald Trump, turned the heat way up. So the frog either dies or it jumps out and fights. And I think the people are going to be playing a strong role here. So I think the people push the Senate, but the senators have to lift their game.
But if I'm the average American person, and I think, you know, both of us to some extent are, although there are obviously going to be some differences. If I get stirred up and want to go out and vote, I'm not going to vote necessarily for the candidate who says I'm going to restore competence and dignity to the legislature and the legislative process. I'm going to vote for the candidate who gives me all of the partisan promises that I want to hear.
Well, I guess I'll debate the point that we're average Americans, because your audience won't think that somebody who's lived in Washington for 40 years like me qualifies like that.
Sure.
But you make a great point. I got a book on my shelf that you may know about by two professors, one of whom is Amy Gutman and her Harvard colleague. And it's sort of The Art of Compromise, Why Governing Demands It and Campaigning Destroys It. So you're right. People don't go out. They don't go out and say, I'm going to restore the Senate or I'm going to be bipartisan. But they go out. They have to win the election, but they can win it in various ways. Doug Jones in Alabama won an election without being rabidly partisan. He tried to broaden his appeal. Obviously, Alabama was a Republican state, and obviously he got lucky in terms of his opponent. But he ran the kind of campaign that allows him to come to Washington and say, I'm going to be a bipartisan deal maker. So they get to Washington if they can win, and then they realize, okay, the campaign is over. Now we've got to govern. And that's the thing that one of the other things that we've lost here, right? Over time, it's referred to, as you know, the permanent campaign. No time for governing. We've always got to just set up the issues for the next election. We got to overcome that. People have to, they can't go year after year just setting up for the next election. And I guess what ties it together and what makes it possible for me to believe this is that senators know that the institution is failing and they hate it, number one. And number two, they know that the American people have lost confidence in them. And at some point, the American people will just throw all of them out. So they have to do better. Not impossible.
Yeah, again, I think you might be more optimistic than I am, but that's a good thing. I'm kind of a cranky old man.
I want to tell you, I make in my speech and in my book, it's not a particularly optimistic book, and then at the end, I turn it by saying, still, I'm relatively optimistic, and then I say, relative to everyone else. I mean, the overwhelming reaction to the whole thing, and I mean all everywhere, oil, is utter despair and anger. Utter despair. And I want to add one thing for the audience listening to this, just to be clear. I am a Democrat, no doubt about it. But I started writing this book in the fall of 2016, when I was sure that Hillary Clinton would win and could not govern unless the Senate changed. So my book isn't a reaction to Donald Trump. I thought the Senate's been failing a long time. That's why I wrote the fourth book. I gave him my second book out exactly to the week, 6 years after the first one. I gave him one more term. And they're still not doing it.
Well, I do want to end this on a positive note. So let's come back to that.
It's been repeatedly positive.
Maybe this isn't negative, but it is a quibble with your book, right? A bit of a pushback with some of what you do. So again, as hopefully is clear from the interview, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. But often through the book, and you've mentioned several times that you're a Democrat, and I'm more on the conservative side. Once upon a time, I would have said that I'm a Republican, and then this Donald Trump guy came along. But often through the book, it sounds like you're setting up a dichotomy between senators, past and present, mostly past, who are selfless and hardworking and kind of virtuous champions of institutional integrity, who are, you know, willing to compromise and promote the common good. All of that sort of on the one hand, and on the other hand, conservative Republicans, and maybe Harry Reid, but even his problems are sort of Mitch McConnell's fault sometimes. So that might be a place where I might say, well, wait a second. This is a bipartisan problem, not rather than just a specifically, you know, Republican problem. But I want to give you a chance to you know, push back against that or say, no, it really is the Republicans' fault or whatever you want to do there.
Well, it's interesting. And I will footnote the fact that you said that you're a conservative and you're not so sure you're a Republican anymore because of President Trump. So I started my career as an intern for Senator Jacob Javits of New York, who was a Republican, although a very liberal Republican.
Sure.
I worked with many Republicans over the years, very closely, including John Danforth of Missouri, mm-hmm. many Republicans. When I came into the Senate and worked there, the people that came in that term were elected in those two Congresses with Jack Danforth and Bill Cohen, Al Simpson, Nancy Kassenbaum.
Sure.
You know, John Hines, Republicans.
Sure.
So it's hard to look at it and say the Republicans haven't moved a whole lot to the right constantly.
Sure.
Like in stages. The Republican leaders have been eaten by the right wing of their own party repeatedly. And McConnell, one reason Senator McConnell is one piece of evidence that he's an extraordinary politician is he's been able to survive it. He's been able to keep control. So, number one, I've worked with a lot of Republicans. I think I've worked with five Republican presidents in their administration. And I stood up with George Bush for an unpopular trade agreement.
Right.
So when I say, you know, it's not just the Republicans. It's an institutional problem of a sort, though, because Barry Goldwater, who was as conservative as possible, he had an enormously fond relationship with Hubert Humphrey. They worked together on things, even though they disagreed on everything. What we have now is tribal politics. And I'll close on one quote, which I think I used in the book, and you may have seen it. Senator Howard Baker, one of the great leaders and a Republican, gave a 1998 speech in which he said, people around the country may see us debating fiercely, and then the next day we get along, and they think we're frauds. But we're not frauds. We have to do it this way. We do the business of the government every day with the same people. This is why we're America and not Bosnia. So he was saying this is the antidote. People working together is the antidote to these tribal politics.
Right.
People who drive us apart, that's not a service to us.
Yeah, and so maybe in wrapping up here, because I don't want to take too much of your time, but two quick closing questions. First, if you could make a practical change to the internal operations of the Senate that wouldn't necessarily solve all of the problems, but it would at least move it back in the right direction, and like a possible real world change.
Yeah.
So you know, the change I would make would be you know, you all have to live in D.C. in the same apartment complex. But so a real world one, not something like that. What practical change would you make to the rules of the Senate just to try to fix some of its issues?
No. I have several practical changes, and I have them in the end of my book. I basically would go back to – I would try to push the Senate back to using – filibusters that were real, that you didn't just basically, now we have numerous filibusters, they're called, but they're not filibusters.
Right.
They're people saying, we won't let you go, we won't give you unanimous consent to proceed, threatened filibusters. I would make people really filibuster, and that's been debated, and I think that would be useful. Related to that closely is the, as you know, the thing called the hole.
Yes.
In 2005, Trent Lott, who was a former leader, said, when did these holes morph from being temporary courtesies to permanent holds on everything? I would abolish the hold, or I would say, I would limit the hold 4 hours so somebody can get back from the airport. I don't think, there's a core issue of the Senate, which has always been, remember, it started as an institution of unlimited debate.
Right.
And then they tried to find different ways to cut off the debate. But they haven't done it in the right balance. And what I proposed is you basically say, look, we're not going to change the rules for this Congress, and not maybe not even for next Congress. But let's have the study and propose it for 2 or 4 years down the line. Get a consensus on something that works. I can get 75 votes for that as long as you're not imposing it one party on the other.
Right. No, I think, I think that's great. And thank you for not saying term limits. I appreciate that a lot.
Let me say one thing about term limits, which I've always opposed. I believe people have to exercise some good judgment and restraint. I don't think people who are 82 or 84 or 85, whether it's Charles Grassley on the Republican side, Dianne Feinstein on the Democratic side, I think they should not run again. I think the norm should be a recognition, as some of them did. Several of them recently said, well, I'm 78, I'm 80. I feel pretty good, but I won't feel that good 6 years from now.
Right.
So I don't believe in term limits, but I do believe in sort of norms and kind of pressure on people.
Right, sort of an informal maximum age of some kind.
Something like that.
My last question for you is, even as you know, someone who's no longer directly involved in the institution, what current senators have you noticed that we, the American public, should really pay attention to and say, hey, these guys, Republicans or Democrats, ideally, if you could give us, you know, a couple from each party, that'd be great. But these are the people we should be watching.
Let me just preface this answer by saying, I always get asked, isn't the problem that these senators just aren't up to it? They're not as good as the great senators. And I always say, not really. There's actually a lot of talented, capable people out there that can do the job, but they're trapped in a dysfunctional, leader-driven institution. So when I think about senators who are really doing well, I think about Patty Murray of Washington and Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. I certainly always think about Susan Collins, who's the only one of them that's a real old friend because we were in the staff together years ago. Susan's very good. She's a throwback to the old Senate. But I think about Jack Reed of Rhode Island. I lost a congressional race years ago to Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, who was a terrific House member and is already going to be a terrific senator. It's not a lack of talent. It's succumbing to the tribal politics, and I object to them allowing the institution to go down and not making more of an effort to change it.
Mr. Ambassador, any final words for our listeners about the Senate, politics, life in general? Anything to close us out on?
Well, you've given me plenty of time to talk, including life in general. I think we're heading into a very perilous year. And the reason that the Senate is so important is that it has to be the balance wheel in our system. And the check on, it was, you know the Constitution. The founders envisioned the Senate as a check on an overreaching executive and maybe the passions that ran through the House of Representatives. Well, that sounds like a good thing to have about now.
Yeah. I completely agree. So, Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Really appreciate the time to talk.
And once again, listeners, let me encourage you to pick up Ira Shapiro's new book, Broken, Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country, published by Roman and Littlefield and available now. And as always, thank you for listening to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our network and get more info about our own show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please do leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at Facebook.com/City of Man podcast, or get in touch with us at CityofManpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. I went a-walkin' that ribbon of highway.